The reading this morning is taken from Mark chapter 8, verses 27 to 38. Peter declares that Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus and his disciples went onto the villages around Caesarea and Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Jesus predicts his death. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." The way of the cross. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." This is the word of the Lord.
Let's pray. Father, in the name of Jesus, I pray that you will take these words and breathe life into them by your Spirit. And when the truth is spoken in love, Lord, it will settle in our hearts and transform us for Christ's sake. Amen. So Maureen and I had the privilege of living in Dallas, Texas for a year after I left Spurgeon's College. And because of that time in America, I was really interested to watch Lucy Worsley on television when she had American History's Biggest Fibs. And in episode one, she looked at the American Revolution, how it was mythologized, manipulated by generations of politicians for their own ends, by writers as they wrote much books on it, and protesters about they wanted the revolution rerun. I guess every one of us could write a book on the lies my teacher told me in my history lessons at school, with hindsight. Hilary Mantel, author of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, remarked, "Hindsight is the historian's necessary vice." The same risk applies with the Bible, because often quoted familiar verses have been overlaid with centuries of ideas and interpretation. Consider what we read today. When Jesus said, "Whoever wanted to follow him must take up his cross," he said it a year before his own arrest, a year before his disciples experienced the event, a year before Jesus describes accurately what was going to occur. And the moment you read those verses today, they are so familiar, your mind immediately goes to the wonderful truth of the atonement, of Christ dying to save us. But Jesus' intent in that verse was not to talk about the atonement. Those hearing him did not simply think of crosses as we think today. As far as they knew, Jesus was speaking to them about one cross, and that was the Romans' preferred device of death for political and criminal prisoners. And that's all. No wonder then, in the midst of that kind of talk, Peter rebukes Jesus, saying, "Look, Lord, you're having a successful mission. You need to come aside with me. I need to discourage you from speaking this way." Now, if that's the case, that Jesus then stopped him in his tracks, the important question then becomes, why? Why did Jesus mention the cross of Rome in this way? It has to be of vital significance for two reasons. Firstly, Jesus never said anything that was irrelevant to his hearers. It wasn't just for those who would understand later by hindsight. His statements always had purpose for his current listeners. Secondly, despite Peter's efforts, he pressed on to give the challenge, I hope you notice it in the reading, to all the crowd, to everyone, and therefore to us. As if you want to follow Jesus, this has to be your mind and will. This is God's will for you, if you decide to follow me. So Jesus is not just speaking generally of a cross, or even the cross. He is instructing those who follow him at that moment to take up their own crosses. So it's vital that we do not read a passage like this and try to apply it to our lives before bothering to understand what it meant to the people who were living it at the time, the people who were recording it for us to read later. Once we do understand it, what it truly means for us, then we will enter with Jesus onto the vulnerable journey. The vulnerability of taking up your cross to follow Jesus. So what did it mean? What does it mean to take up your cross? What were the implications when Jesus spoke these words? In the Roman Empire, it signified four things. The first one was opposition, a place where criminals were put to die in front of a crowd. It was public opposition to those individuals. You get the idea in that great film Spartacus, which I watched many times when I was a teenager. You get to that poignant moment when they're defeated and the Roman general says, "I want Spartacus." Kirk Douglas steps forward. "I'm Spartacus." Then the next person steps forward and says, "I'm Spartacus," until the whole of Spartacus' men are standing with him. They understood what it meant to take up the cross, because from that moment in the film, all you see is one cross or another, all the way down the road to Rome. Public opposition. Secondly, shame. It was designed to utterly humiliate by stripping away every last ounce of human dignity. You were paraded to the place of execution, and then you were hung naked after constant beatings. Thirdly, suffering. If you hang on a cross, it is a suffocating weight of your own body, as you had to constantly push down on your feet and pull up on your hands just to breathe for hours on end. Fourthly, it meant death. And if that asphyxiation of having to lift yourself up and down didn't bring death quickly enough, they broke your legs to hasten it. Death was its aim. Never torture, because there was never a release to follow. And Jesus is calling his hearers to be prepared for this if they come after him, if they follow him. To follow Jesus in the Roman world, to say Jesus is Lord in the first century, was to say that Caesar was not. God's rule for me, not man's. And I find it an amazing fact that Jesus used the cross, the Roman cross, to make his point well before Rome attempted to use one on him to make their point. But here's the thing. We're not called to carry Jesus' cross, but our own. It seems bizarre to me that in history, Jesus' instruction has so often moved from carrying the cross on our backs to becoming a symbol on shields of conquest and glory. From being the device of our sacrifice to being the exercise of power to sacrifice others. Whenever that happens, we have stopped following Jesus and become self-serving imperialists. Self is no longer being denied, but empowered against the gospel of Christ. So are you willing to take up your cross? Am I willing to take up my cross? To be willing, without complaint, without criticizing God or pulling back, to be opposed, to be shamed, to suffer, and ultimately to die for faithfully following him. Are you willing to follow Jesus if it means losing some of your closest friends? My parents' best friends were both Christians. They were called to serve on the mission field. They were engaged to be married. They went to college. And while they were at college, she was called to Africa and he was called to South America. They were willing because, however they looked at it, they could not shake off that conviction of the call to serve Jesus where he had said. And so they broke off their engagement in agreement and went their separate ways. Are you willing to follow Jesus if it means alienation from your family? The guy who's now pastor of the church in Grantham where we were, when he became a Christian, his parents were shocked. They expected him to be a good northern lad and go about his business. And here he was becoming this weak, livered Christian. And initially they broke that pattern of love for him. Are you willing to follow Jesus if it means loss of your reputation? Are you willing to follow Jesus if it means losing your job? Mike's a good friend of ours, and he was working for a Christian man in a company in London doing logistics on the docks. One day his boss called him in and said, you know that ship that's coming in now? I just want you to do this with this piece of paper. Mike looked at it and said, I'm sorry, that's illegal. You pay me to tell you that. Just do it, Mike. No questions. Or you're out of here. Mike said, well, you know that I'm a Christian. And he put the piece of paper on the table, turned round and left his job. This is a man who is supporting his family, and both his children have got cystic fibrosis. Now, there's another part to that story that is a good end. So I want to tell you that it doesn't all end badly. But are you willing? Are you willing to follow Jesus if it means losing your life? But here's the wonderful thing. You know the promise of God gave during his ministry to the vulnerable. A bruised reed he will not break. I want Jesus more than anything. When I came this morning, Eric said, I don't know why, but we're going to have that song stay because you liked it the a cappella way when we had it before. I've got no great thing. It was absolutely right, wasn't it? I want Jesus more than any more. Stay with me. How we love someone is clear to be seen by everyone from how we serve them or neglect them. Were we designed to wear love on our sleeves? In the long run, we cannot fake who we are or what we really serve. it will be obvious whether you have truly taken up our cross. Watchman Nee has a very simple story that for me catches the impact of Jesus' call. He said, I've got a friend, he gets on a train, and he's sitting there in the railway carriage, can't do it with this jacket. He had his arms up his sleeves, and the people in the carriage started to gamble. And they invited him to join in. And he says to them, I have not brought my hands with me. They knew where his hands were. So he takes time to explain to them as he brings his hands out and says, these hands belong to the Lord Jesus Christ. And I want to tell you what he means to me and the love that he has for me and I have for you and for the world. And I cannot use these hands to tarnish or dishonor his name. The choice of the moment when to reveal the cross that you're carrying does not have to be great. It just has to be consistent. Paul set me quite a task. He said about vulnerability, and then he said about the paradox of self-denial and becoming vulnerable. The paradox of self-denial is part of the inner debate in our hearts and souls and minds. A paradox is from the Greek para and doxa, against opinion. Apparent contradiction or logical absurdity. Here's some examples, which I hope are going to come up on the screen. I might have to turn around to read them myself. Answer truthfully, yes or no, to the following question. Will the next word you say be no? You have to think about it. If you say no, you've lied. If you say yes, you've lied. It's that paradox of a question. Here's another one. What happens if you're in a car going the speed of light and you turn the headlights on? Here's another one. The curious paradox is that when I accept myself just as I am, then I can change. Finally, we learn from history that we do not learn from history. That one's in the context of our message today. St. Augustine describes the paradox in self-denial like this. If you love your soul, there is a danger of its being destroyed. Therefore, you may not love it, since you do not want it to be destroyed. But in not wanting it to be destroyed, you love it. I'll come back to that later. What is self-denial? Self-denial does not mean seeking or embracing abuse for its own sake, as if suffering itself is a redemptive mark of virtue or value. Just think, Mark chapter 8 is what we read. He's just spent 7 chapters showing Jesus alleviating needless suffering or oppression whenever he encountered it. So he cannot be endorsing suffering for suffering's sake. I challenge you this morning, do not allow this text, take up your cross and follow me, deny yourself, to perpetuate or excuse victimization. I don't believe we can say, that's the cross I have to carry, it's my cross to bear. I'm being honest with you, my mother suffered from depression a lot of her life, and it used to make me cringe when she said, that's my cross I have to bear. It is not what Jesus meant. And I loved her. And we cared for her. Jesus was not referring to the things that cause us problems in life. The kind of suffering Jesus acknowledges in this passage is the reality of if a particular kind, persecution resulting from following him. For my sake and the gospel's, the verse says. Self-denial and redefinition come with their risks. Self-denial, John Calvin said, constitutes the sum of the Christian life, since it is not primarily about squashing our desires or even delaying gratification, but the call of Christ to separate ourselves from what defines us. A person in Jesus' culture was defined by those to whom he belonged, usually his household or his family. Jesus calls us to embrace a new understanding of identity. Disciples join a community defined by association with Jesus. We want Jesus more than anything else. We want him to stay with us. Self-denial is not annihilation, self-annihilation, but complete redefinition. The word life in this passage is critical. Four times Jesus uses it to show that he is appealing to us about the desire for life when talking about taking up our cross. He gives four arguments, or if you like, four incentives of obeying this command. Jesus signals these four arguments with four logical connectors. There's four verses, I hope. Four. Whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Each argument is supported or grounded by the one following it. And Jesus gives these four reasons and motives to obey his call. Take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. Inside us is a self that desires to be accepted, to be honored and comforted, and to live in safety. Do you like those things? I like them. That's our natural self. Our natural self desires these things, thinking that they will make us happy in life. However, Jesus says that we are going to have to deny that self. Why? Because there is a conflict between those two selves. One sees life through following Jesus, and the other sees life following its own way. To deny oneself doesn't mean to go without something or even many things. Denying oneself is not asceticism, which I hope we've got a definition of up here. Ascesis, askew, exercise training. It was what the athletes did. They honed their bodies. And today, a rigorous, laborious lifestyle involving the denial of pleasure and rest as a way of expressing spiritual devotion. James L. May puts it slightly differently. A program of asceticism allows the self to win its own victory. Nor is self-denial self-rejection or self-hatred. It's not even the disowning of particular sins. The definition of self-denial as mere self-restraint ultimately reveals itself as a self-assertive concern to keep behavior in check. Rather, self-denial is to renounce the self as the dominant element in life. It is to place the will of God before our own self-will. The new self tells the old, and I'm quoting John Piper here because I thought it was very well put, "I love Jesus more than human approval, honor, comfort, and life. So I'm ready to endure opposition, shame, suffering, and death. There is more gain in following Jesus, even with suffering, than there is in walking away from him, even with 10,000 earthly benefits." To do this is to be vulnerable, to be called to where you do not want to go, to surrender a friendship that will prevent you doing God's will, to stand for a justice or righteousness that will lead you to be under threat because it stands over against the direction of authority. To take up the cross and deny oneself does not necessarily mean any of these things will happen, but to claim our willingness without fear or hesitation is to accept the vulnerability of that possibility for Christ's sake. I was watching the program last night, The Rise of the Nazis, and my mind immediately went to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who would not stop saying, "This is wrong. This is not God's will." And he went all the way to suffering the ultimate penalty of holding that cross before Hitler. This is Jesus' view of the paradox presented in his words. Take up your cross, deny yourself and follow me. When we deny ourselves, that wants acceptance, that wants glory, honor and credit, comfort and safety for our own sake, then we are at risk of losing everything that God promises. But when we say no to the old self and are willing for his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, in us, through us, whatever that may be, we can expect life and life eternal. Christ guarantees it by walking the same road ahead of us, carrying his cross so that we might follow behind him. By ensuring that the road of death is not a cul-de-sac. So let's never cheapen the concept of taking up the cross and self-denial. Let's not cheapen it by applying it to enduring some irritation or even a major burden. For Jesus literally carried his cross, and many of the martyrs that followed him did so as well. So when St. Augustine wrote, "If you lose your soul, there is a danger of its being destroyed. Therefore you may not love it, since you do not want it to be destroyed. But in not wanting it to be destroyed, you love it." He means, by losing your life and denying its will, you are truly loving it, not wanting to be left outside God's will in the cold. I think C.S. Lewis says, "There is no safe investment. To love at all is to be vulnerable." The full paragraph fills out the truth. Love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give your heart to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all the entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. The alternative to tragedy, or at least to the risk of tragedy, is damnation. The only place outside heaven when you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell. Only Christ can bring you into the warmth of God's love forever. I mentioned Watchman Nee earlier, and in his book, The Normal Christian Life, he describes it like this: "I must first have the sense of God's possession of me before I can have the sense of his presence with me." If we do take up our cross and deny ourselves, then these four things are true. Self-denial sets us free to be content. I'm not going to say all of this, but I'm going to go straight to the verse at the end of the paragraph. "But godliness with contentment is of great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." Self-denial sets us free to live in peace. It helps us to lay down the burden and leave it behind us. You know, we can spend weeks, months, even years in a perpetual stew because some little thing did not go the way we wanted. Self-denial sets us free from that drive so that we can live in peace and with one another. And don't think the church is immune in this regard. Remember, James, the brother of John, wrote about John and himself and what they did to Jesus when they wanted the best seats. That was self, not self-denial. What causes fights and quarrels among you, he writes to the church? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? We need to seek and listen to one another. And self-denial brings peace. Self-denial sets us free to embrace the cross. We can't embrace the cross when we're busy embracing all the distractions of this world. This is why the order in Jesus' call is to deny oneself first, then take up your cross and follow him. Self-denial sets us free to follow Jesus. Why? Because the things of this world no longer have a grip on us. We're no longer bound by them. You know the old hymn writer said, "Turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace." That's Jesus' way. Think of yourselves the way Jesus Christ thought of himself. He had equal status with God, but didn't think so much of himself that he had to cling to the advantages of that status no matter what. Not at all. When the time came, he set aside the privileges of deity and took on the status of a slave. He became human. Having become human, he stayed human. It was an incredibly humbling process. He didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life and then died a selfless, obedient death. And the worst kind of death at that, a crucifixion. The very vulnerability of Jesus Christ encourages us to follow him. So in preparing this message, I thought about all the vulnerabilities that Jesus accepted living on earth. And I have got a long list if you want to see them afterward. It's not exhaustive. But you know what got to me most of all was when I thought of him after the resurrection, standing there, bearing the wounds of vulnerability in his hands and side and feet. Having become human, he stayed human. The Lord has chosen not to remove from our sight those nail prints and pierced side. Our sovereign God, omnipotent, nevertheless chooses to bear the marks of human vulnerability for our sake forever, that we may be with him. It is no small thing then to deny oneself and take up our cross and follow him, come what may. But the motivation is equally clear. What lies ahead is glory. We look away from the natural realm and we fasten our gaze onto Jesus, who birthed faith within us and who leads us forward into faith perfection. His example is this: because his heart was focused on the joy of knowing that that you would be his, he endured the agony of the cross and conquered its humiliation, and now sits exalted at the right-hand throne of God. Following Jesus is the best motivation you can to live out this call. Take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. Let's do that as we come to communion now.